produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today. Study finds no causal link between marijuana use and depression. Research to be published in the October issue of the journal Addiction indicates no causal link between smoking marijuana and the later development of clinical depression. Investigators at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and the Bloomberg School of Public Health in Santa Monica conducted the longitudinal study of over 12,000 individuals over a 17-year period. Researchers sought to determine, quote, whether marijuana use predicts later development of depression, close quote. Investigators concluded, quote, after adjusting for differences in baseline risk factors of marijuana use and depression, past year marijuana use does not significantly predict the later development of depression, close quote. The authors added, quote, the findings supported in this paper suggest that the associations observed between marijuana use and subsequent depression status may be attributable not to continued marijuana use per se, but to third common factors associated with both the decision to use marijuana and to depression, close quote. A previous study published last year in the journal Addictive Behaviors determined that adults who use cannabis report suffering from less severe incidents and or symptoms of depression than non-users. Quote, despite comparable ranges of scores on all depression subscales, those who used once per week or less had less depressed mood, more positive effect, and fewer somatic or physical complaints than non-users, close quote, the authors wrote. They continued, quote, these data suggest that adults apparently do not increase their risk for depression by using marijuana, close quote. Stay tuned today on the Audio Stash for an extended interview with Dr. Mitch Earlywine regarding this new data. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. In a news focus interview today, we'll speak with a regular Wednesday voice on the Audio Stash, Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch was one of the first scientists to investigate cannabis and depression, and today we present an important interview. It's rare that a myth surrounding smoked marijuana can be so soundly proven wrong by real science. Each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash, we have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who is Associate Professor of Psychology at State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the just-released book Pot Politics, Marijuana and the Costs of Prohibition. Today, we feature an extended interview with Dr. Earlywine. Recent scientific data published in the October Journal of Addiction presents important data about smoking marijuana and depression. Dr. Earlywine has conducted some of the most respected research in the area of cannabis and depression. Mitch, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Always a pleasure, Chris.
Great to speak with you again today, Mitch. Yesterday, we had a fascinating discussion with Paul Armentano about the cannabinoid receptor system, and Paul forwarded me this new journal report coming out in the October issue of Addiction about depression and cannabis in what's called a longitudinal study. First, Mitch, what is a longitudinal study, and what were the scientists looking for in this research?
Chris, some of your listeners who are regulars probably remember a study that I did with Tom Denson where I had folks fill out a depression questionnaire and a measure of how much marijuana they smoked, and showed that there wasn't really a link between depression and marijuana smoke, but it was right then at the same time. It was how they were experiencing their depression and their cannabis use right then at the exact same time. In a longitudinal study, what you do is have people do what I did and then follow them up again years later. What makes me so excited and simultaneously jealous of this harder study is that they have a huge sample who they had fill out measures of cannabis use and depression, and then literally 4 years later could come back and have them do the same things. This is a much better test of whether cannabis actually could cause depression, because you can look at across that four-year span, did heavy cannabis users develop depression later? Whereas with studies like mine, people would say, oh, well, you know, they haven't had the depression yet. It hasn't hit them, but it's going to hit them any time now. With this harder study, it's just absolutely clear that that's not the case. And I find this longitudinal design as compelling as they get in human research of marijuana and depression.
Now, in this study, they looked at people who continued to smoke marijuana and those who stopped smoking at some point. So what kind of difference is there in past versus current use on the body in this study?
As it turns out, at least based on these data, it's not a big deal at all. Once you take out the other obvious contributors to depression, it's really not a link to marijuana that is statistically significant or even meaningful to anybody. So if I could explain this, basically imagine a non-smoker, a person who's never used cannabis, that person's risk for getting depression. The risk for getting depression among marijuana users is essentially identical. So whether they'd quit or whether they had used again in the previous year didn't seem to matter. These folks weren't developing more depressive symptoms than their pals who had quit or had never used.
So Mitch, using your research and this data just published, we can close the book here and say there is no causal link between smoking marijuana and being depressed.
I think in some ways, I rarely say this about research, but this is it. We really don't need more research on this topic. And it's funny for a scientist to say that, but I think this is pretty well established. The sample is over 12,000 people, right? The lag is 4 years. I mean, we've got every single thing we could do to see if this effect is there, and it's just not there. I imagine, you know, prohibitionists are going to say, well, there's a subset of people who it does happen for them, and we're going to find them. But this new study suggests that they looked at each gender separately. They looked at younger folks. They looked at older folks. Clearly, if marijuana caused depression, they ought to have found it, and it just isn't there. So I would love to see an end to this myth of marijuana causing depression.
Mitch, yesterday we spoke with Paul Armentano about those cannabinoid receptors. They're most prevalent in the brain in and around the hippocampus. What types of things happen in the hippocampus if you're depressed?
It's curious because I hate to reduce depression to a few brain structures and a few chemicals, but the cannabinoid system and the hippocampus in particular is involved in memory and mood, and you can imagine how memory and mood are altered in depressed folks. So many depressive people, when you ask them, you know, think of something fun that happened to you recently, they have a real hard time doing it, and that hippocampal involvement, that involvement of that brain structure in the memories of happy times, may be part of what's being impaired. Now, the idea that the cannabinoid system might help fire some portions of the hippocampus that wouldn't fire under other circumstances still needs to be tested, and it may not be quite that direct, it may not be quite that limited to that specific brain structure, but that potential is there. And the notion that, well, marijuana would be somehow depressing the hippocampus or messing up your mood because of that seems rather unlikely.
Now, the depression study we're talking about today, this is sort of a direct response trying to prove or disprove a supposed harmful effect of cannabis. And again, marijuana has proven nearly harmless in this context. But is there more research out there into trying to prove these mythical harms rather than look into the real benefits?
It's funny because I feel like particularly the damages that are alleged in pop culture seem to get a lot of attention, and I feel like researchers now are ahead of the curve, so that the general public, for example, thinks that marijuana and aggression might be linked. I recently submitted a paper showing that that was not the case, and the reviews came back from the editor saying, oh, come on, everybody knows this, which I had to chuckle because I still hear, you know, from various offices in Washington that marijuana does cause aggression, and scientists are dismissing this and have been for years. I think now scientists will dismiss the notion of marijuana causing depression, and it'll be harder and harder to publish studies on this because it seems so obviously disproved, but it's going to take a while for all of us to get the word out to the lay public that this should no longer be a concern.
We're speaking with Dr. Mitch Earlywine today. Mitch, one of the questions we received via email from a podcast listener after our first discussion of cannabis and depression was this: would it be harder to spot the early signs of depression if you're a regular cannabis consumer?
I think that is an intriguing question. I do have some data to suggest that although regular marijuana users aren't at higher risk for depression, folks who are dependent on cannabis might be at higher risk. And so if you've got symptoms of tolerance and withdrawal, which are relatively rare with cannabis, but if you have those, I could see how that could be contributing to a deviant mood, and then it would be hard to tell. Is this depression or is this some kind of trouble I'm having with cannabis? And all I could recommend is, hey, take some time off. We could all use a month off from cannabis if we've been regular smokers. Let's see how things go when you do that. And, boy, what an easy intervention that would be relative to, you know, some of the pharmacological treatments that are often prescribed for depression and things like that.
And, Mitch, let me take this opportunity to pose another listener question that we get a lot, and it's a tough, tough one to answer. Mitch, a lot of folks have asked us what quantity or frequency of smoking cannabis might be too much. So how much is reasonable use and how much is problem use?
In fact, I never really thought of a quantity or a frequency as the way to determine if marijuana is a problem. The real issue is, how is it altering your life? If you're underemployed, if you go to work and have accidents because you're high there, obviously that's just not the way to do it. If you're driving and intoxicated, I really think that that's just a bad idea. If you have loved ones who are complaining that they can't connect with you because your intoxication is really frequent, I think that's a problem. And focusing on those issues rather than, hey, I only get high two times a week or five, or, you know, is there a magic number, I don't think that's the issue. I think it's much more about how is my work, how is my social life, how is my recreational life, and that should tell you something. One thing I tell my students is, when was the last time you saw a movie and you were high? And when was the last time you saw one and you weren't, right? Do I have to do all my recreation high? Well, I think that that's a red flag. Do I have to have all my interactions with all my friends be around marijuana? Then I think that's a problem. But if this is something that I use on occasion to enhance an experience, or, you know, in the evening for the last little bit of my day, I'd be hard-pressed to find out what the negative consequences of that are. So that's what I would recommend.
Now, departing from this research data a bit, let's take this to the other end of the spectrum. If we now know that the scientific evidence is that smoking marijuana does not cause depression, what about individuals who are already depressed for some other reason, even clinically depressed? Could they perhaps find some relief from cannabis?
It's not my first choice treatment. I feel like there are cognitive treatments and good psychotherapies for depression that in as little as 3 months can really turn your life around. I feel like, particularly since I'm on the East Coast and winter's coming, the seasonal affective disorder, where people can get themselves a bright light and shine that on themselves and a half hour every morning, and they have their symptoms improve pretty dramatically. But there are literally dozens of case studies of individuals who say cannabis improves their mood and decreases their depressive symptoms. And, in fact, as we're learning more and more about the cannabinoid receptor, that sort of makes sense. So I wouldn't say, hey, you're depressed, here, have some marijuana. I would recommend these other treatments first. But I would doubt that marijuana is causing an individual's depression, and I would have to doubt that in any way it was impossible that marijuana would help.
Mitch, that is a great viewpoint. I thank you for that. Also, I want to get back to an important topic. Earlier, you mentioned light therapy for those not getting enough of the right bandwidths of light, and this is a real physical effect. I hear it's also a very common problem for college students who spend all day in class or the lecture hall and then all night in the computer lab. So how does this light therapy work?
I got to be candid with you and all the listeners. I lived in California for 14 years and forgot I had this seasonal affective symptoms, moved to New York and had to get a light right away. And I think it's really worth the investment to spend $100 on a really great light and get under it for the first half hour of your day, and then make sure you have time when it's before bed, when you're not in front of the screen, when you're not in front of bright lights and all that stuff, so that you get the chance to really get your sleep the way it ought to be, and the depressive symptoms disappear in 2 weeks or less. It's just astounding.
And you mentioned some of the lights. What should someone be looking for if they want to get one?
The key is the lux, how much actual light gets out. And so I don't want to plug a certain brand or anything, but obviously the more the better. I would say you ought to be able to get a good one for $150 to $200, and that it's really, really worth the investment, because when you think about other depression interventions, they're usually run longer and end up more expensive, where this is one that is actually quite pleasant and has literally no negative consequences. So.
This seems to be one of the most common causes for depression, known as the winter blues, and it often goes unrecognized.
Oh, it is. It is rampantly underdiagnosed, and I know of some libraries in Vermont where people can just go into the library and sit under them, and I'd love to see that happen, up and down every winter area around. I would love to see that as a public service. That'd be super.
So just to recap here today, the real lesson from your research and this recent Addiction Journal report, you will not get depressed from smoking cannabis. And don't smoke pot if you are depressed. Seek cognitive therapy or perhaps light therapy first.
I think that's a great take-home message.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine is Associate Professor of Psychology at State University in New York and author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, and editor of the just-released book Pot Politics, Marijuana and the Costs of Prohibition. We have links to the books and an archive of our conversations with Dr. Earlywine at normalaudio-com. Next up on the Audio Stash today, we'll hear from Dr. Stephen Karsh, M.D., a cardiologist, in his talk to the Normal 2006 conference in San Francisco. Dr. Karsh discusses the research regarding smoking cannabis and conditions related to the heart. Rarely does a medical professional offer such a candid discussion of issues regarding cannabis smokers' health. Normal conferences and press activity are the best way for this type of information to be presented to the public. Here's Dr. Stephen Karsh at the 2006 Normal Conference.
Why am I pointing this out? Well, 12 million is a big number, but it's not as big as the number of people that have coronary artery disease or vascular disease. Vascular disease, CVD, coronary or cardiovascular disease, is the leading cause of death in America. 60 million people, in other words, five times as many as dope smoke, there are people smoking dope, have one form or another of cardiovascular disease. They've either had a heart attack, they've had a stroke, or they are living with the sequela of a heart attack or a stroke. What does this mean? Well, what it means is there's a huge overlap. Just by chance alone, it's highly probable somebody who has a heart attack will have smoked marijuana at some point or other, or maybe even when they've had the heart attack. What kind of evidence do we have that marijuana could cause heart attacks? Well, what we have are case reports, and these have been appearing kind of regularly since the early 1970s. I'm really sad John Morgan isn't here today, because he goes off on a pretty good tirade about this sort of thing. But the reports do appear, and they appear in respectable journals. But really, what they are describing is, in fact, the coincidence of somebody having a heart attack and somebody smoking dope. Now, maybe the marijuana is responsible for the heart attack. Maybe it's not. The only way to tell is to do a clinical trial, or, barring clinical trials, because you'd have to involve a lot of people, an epidemiologic study. So a case report, which can be really legitimate, there was a very impressive one in the American Journal of Forensic Science, or the International Journal of Forensic Science last year, described four people who keeled over and died while taking a toke. And I think it was pretty impressive, and I think it was responsible for their deaths. But we'll explain why I think that in a minute. Barring the clinical trials, all you can do is an epidemiologic study, and those have been done. We know that in controlled settings, people that haven't smoked marijuana before develop tachycardia, high rapid heart rate, and develop increased systolic. That's the first number in your blood pressure, but not diastolic pressure. But we also know that as they smoke marijuana regularly, this goes away. Both the change in the blood pressure and the change in the pulse rate are not significant in regular marijuana smokers. That's not the problem. The problem is your heart is connected to your brain. Maybe an indirect connection, but believe me, all the nerves that control how the heart, blood vessels, and muscle behave come from the brain. Marijuana affects the brain, and now we also know that there are marijuana receptors in the heart, both type CB1 and CB2. It's virtually impossible in a human study to separate out the two components, whether we're talking about the heart or the brain telling the heart what to do. So in the good news category, we have reports in the experimental literature in the last year that in spontaneously hypertensive rats, in other words, rats that develop high blood pressure automatically, if you block the breakdown of anandamide, which is the classic marijuana receptor binding chemical, then you know what happens? The blood vessels dilate. That means that there's more anandamide present. It causes blood vessels to dilate. That's a good thing, probably, except in some certain athletic situations. But what's the bad news that goes with it? Because there always is. Another study just published showed that THC decreases the ability of the heart to contract, and it decreased coronary blood flow. Those are very bad things. In humans, one large epidemiologic study found that there was no association between marijuana smoking and cardiovascular disease or early death from any cause. But the bad news is that in another large study, people who already had coronary artery disease developed angina quicker and symptoms quicker if they smoked marijuana. And there have been several studies repeating the findings of both the good study and the bad study. So which one do you want to pick? Even though it appears that the stimulation of the cannabinoid receptors in the heart can cause increased flow, we don't really know, because all these experiments are done in isolated hearts, we don't really know whether that's what happens in people. Now, just within the last 18 months, both of the cannabinoid receptors have been discovered within the human heart and on coronary arteries. That has pretty big implications. In some situations, that was an interesting noise. All the shows last night, you know, were the anniversary of earthquake, and I'm kind of hyper. I want to go home. Sometimes you get contraction of the blood vessels in experimental animals, and sometimes you get dilation. The problem is rats ain't people most of the time. You know. And it's really hard to say whether the receptors are in the same place. Think about this, though. If this stuff is really, really dangerous, how is it that no case of myocardial infarction has ever been reported in somebody taking Marinol, which is synthetic THC? Never been one. So that sort of suggests that there's nothing inherently cardiotoxic about the compound, but that superimposed on a pre-existing disease, you may be running into a problem. This is a coronary artery. I actually cheated. This is from a cocaine user. I couldn't find a marijuana user. But that's what a blocked artery looks like. And here's the problem. Here's how it works. Even eyeballing it, not being cardiac pathologist, you can look at that and say, well, it's about 25% blocked, right? Everybody agree that that little white spot, which is the open part of the artery, takes up about a quarter of the whole artery's inner circumference. Is that apparent to everybody? Okay. You don't get angina until you block half the artery. Right? You don't get symptoms until you block half the artery. You can run a marathon with a half-blocked artery. Reason why is the heart has a lot of backup reserve. And even with a half-blocked artery, you get enough blood through so that the backup systems work, no trouble. Over 50%, you start to get symptoms on hard exertion. At 75%, you reach a critical mass. This would be a surgical lesion if anybody knew that it had existed before the man died suddenly. All right? Well, if you make your heart go faster, that makes your heart work harder. Why? Because the way we calculate the way the heart works is the blood pressure times the heart rate. So that increases the amount of blood needed, oxygen needed by the heart to stay alive. What happens in the marijuana users who die while smoking, every single one that's been reported so far, is that they all have a lesion like this. They all have a critical lesion. And this marijuana smoking does put enough strain on their heart to cause an infarct. Well, you will say, that's a pretty stupid thing to do if you've got a lesion like that. The problem is most people don't know that these lesions can progress very quickly. Every single case that's been reported of a marijuana-related smoking death has been one of these. Now, one last thing. This I want to tell you about a paper that's 3 days old. It just came from Paris. And it's on how cannabinoids protect from myocardial ischemia. One of the puzzles that I've always had, you know, this town has a history of meth, and I was glad to see the tradition was upheld when they busted some more Hells Angels last night. But if you study any large group of meth-related deaths, what you see is very fascinating. They all have kind of a lot of coronary artery disease, like was up on the screen, but they almost never have heart attacks. In fact, there's a medical student sitting over there. And if you want to get a paper published, just write a paper about a methamphetamine-related heart attack. They're rare. It's just been discovered within the last few years that methamphetamine turns on something called heat shock protein. And heat shock protein made in the brain protects the heart from ischemia. So that explains why for all these years I've seen these people with rotten-looking coronaries who don't have heart attacks. They die because they get shot or run over by a truck or whatever. But they don't die from heart attacks, and heart attacks from meth are rare. It's starting to look like we have the same situation with marijuana, that in fact it is exerting protective effects against ischemia, will prevent from heart attacks, so maybe it's a built-in system. I would not tell anybody out there with heart disease to go smoke dope. On the other hand, one reason maybe the heart attacks are so rare is that it is activating some protective systems. That's all I needed to tell you about today on the subject.
That was Dr. Stephen Karsh, MD, a cardiologist, in his talk to the Normal 2006 conference in San Francisco.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
This has been Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to Podshow.com for all the great pod-safe music. We feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. Thanks to Red Aphid Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.